If any place could grapple with such a bizarre and troubling situation, Berkeley could. The university was the birthplace of the very version of the Unix operating system that the rogue program was targeting when it broke into computers on the network. During the evening, it became apparent that the intended targets of the mysterious program were computers made by Sun Microsystems and the Digital Equipment Corporation, two of the most common machines on the Internet. 15 minutes after Lapsley first noticed it, the program had broken into at least 30 workstations on the Berkeley campus. From the way it was acting, it appeared to be a selective beast, setting its sights on machines that were connected to as many other systems as possible. It used simple, quick, and powerful methods to break in immediately. Two Berkeley computers were especially attractive targets. One, called CSGW, which was a gateway to local area networks on the Berkeley campus, crashed after dozens of copies of the virus arrived. So did UCBVAX, a major gateway to the Internet. It seemed that infecting such a vital organ had strategic value for the program, increasing manyfold the number of computers it could reach in just a single hop. Thus, UCBVAX was under constant attack. Still, the team of Berkeley defenders decided against pulling their computers off the network. That would have been admitting defeat. The challenge, they decided, was to stay connected to the network and still kill off the program. One of Berkeley's first tasks was to capture a snapshot of the program as it was running, in an effort to catch it in freeze frame and then to analyze it. From there, they could examine strings of code and try to figure out what the program was doing. But most of it was encrypted, as if whoever wrote it knew someone would take such a snapshot. The Berkeley programmers found that the coding scheme used to obscure the program was a simple one. Unscrambling the data was much like a child's game of translating words from Pig Latin. The programmers quickly uncovered the original instructions. The snapshot of code also told the programmers that the program was trying to crack passwords using what was known as a dictionary attack, comparing encrypted passwords to an online dictionary that had been encrypted. The snapshot also showed them the program was using cracked passwords to get into one system, then go from there to other computers by taking advantage of the fact that a password validation on one computer often grants access to other computers across the network. Other things quickly became obvious. The Berkeley programmers soon figured out that the program was exploiting a subtle flaw or bug in a communications program called Sendmail, which it used to send messages and data between computers over the network. The flaw in Sendmail rose from the subtle concatenation of two features of the program, much as a binary poison gas is deadly only when two inert gases are combined. One feature made it possible for someone at a remote location to embed a program in a message. Instead of being handled as an electronic letter, the message fooled the computer into running it as a program. The second feature allowed those programmers who needed to debug or maintain the mail program to examine mail connections over the network. This debug feature made it possible to switch on the first feature from a remote location. Once the first feature had been switched on, a program embedded in electronic mail could be sent to run on another computer immediately. The combination of the two features, known to only a few, proved to be a glaring loophole in the mail program. Whoever had written the rogue program made use of this obscure flaw to send small scout or grappling hook programs across the network. This program, in turn, immediately called back and brought over the main body of the virus. Having taken hold of each new computer, the process would repeat itself indefinitely. That much, at least, was obvious. Their first look at the program suggested to the Berkeley group that the invader had no intention of destroying data. Apparently, it examined actual information inside computers only in order to find ways of breaking into other systems. But they realized that was just a superficial impression. The possibility of a Trojan horse still lingered. The only way to determine what it was actually doing would be to pick it apart line by line, a painstaking task that could take days or weeks. Until the program had been thoroughly analyzed, with microscope and tweezers, as programmers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology titled a later paper on the virus, there was no knowing what kind of dangers lurked inside. For the next 3 hours, programmers at both the Experimental Computing Facility in Corey Hall and the Computer Systems Research Group, the CSRG, on the fourth floor of Evans Hall, worked simultaneously at shaking the program out of their systems and building a clearer understanding of how it worked. If it were a playful hoax, they reasoned, wouldn't it have come with a set of instructions on how to get rid of it? But there were no such instructions, and all potentially useful details hidden inside were encoded, sheltered from prying eyes. The program tried to remain hidden by giving itself the name of an innocuous command that its author obviously hoped would avoid scrutiny. Apparently, the idea was that to anyone taking casual stock of the computer's activities, nothing would appear out of the ordinary. And to further elude detection, like a chameleon, the program constantly changed its identifying number, taking on new aliases to make itself less conspicuous. By 11 p.m., most of the Berkeley programming staff had congregated in one of the two computer labs. Keith Bostick, a 28-year-old programmer at CSRG, was in his office at Evans Hall, working with Mike Carrolls. As two of the principal software engineers behind Berkeley Unix, they had good reason to take the attack personally. Bostick had seen his machines hacked and crashed by outsiders before, but this episode was on an entirely new scale. Meanwhile, Lapsley and a group of others gathered in the fishbowl at Corey Hall. At 11:30 p.m., Peter Yee sent out a message from Berkeley to an electronic mailing list on the Internet. "We are currently under attack from an Internet virus," the message began. "It has hit UC Berkeley, UC San Diego, Lawrence Livermore, Stanford, and NASA Ames." Fueled by adrenaline, sugar, and caffeine, the Berkeley group was meeting the break-in head-on. A software invader that brought scores, perhaps hundreds, of computers to their knees was just the sort of nightmare that every computer manager feared. At the same time, it was as if someone had just handed the group at Berkeley an imposing crossword puzzle to solve, the ultimate challenge. And the possibility that the program could contain virulent code infused the evening with tension. Someone made a sign that read, "Center for Disease Control," and taped it to the door of the experimental computing facility. Sometime after midnight, Lapsley walked back to a machine room containing most of Corey Hall's largest computers and began the arduous task of going from machine to machine, plugging the holes the invader was using and killing off all copies of the foreign program. He reconfigured each system with a patch that blocked the sendmail loophole, and in Evans there were dozens more. One by one, the Berkeley computers were immunized from the attacker. Berkeley had survived the plague. By 3 a.m. Thursday, the tired programmers knew enough about the program to issue a broad alert to other computer sites. Bostick sent messages to several electronic mailing lists describing how to fix systems in a way that would stop the program. His message reached some parts of the network, but unfortunately not the centers that had already cut themselves away from the network and were working in solitude to stop the rogue program. The Internet sites that stayed connected found their messages bogged down by a form of electronic gridlock. The program had clogged some of the network's crucial mail machines. In some cases, it took messages hours, even days, to travel routes that normally took a few minutes. Exhausted, Bostick went home to sleep. Lapsley stayed in the fishbowl. He knew the program was somehow using other methods to break in, but he hadn't yet been able to figure out exactly what they were. At 8:30 a.m. Thursday, Lapsley finally went home too. It had been one of the most harrowing nights that anyone in the computer science community had ever faced. For others, though, it was just the beginning. The following morning, news of the program spread around the country. Word of the previous night's invasion had circulated not just among computer scientists, but in the national press as well. During the day, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the nation's leading weapons laboratories, held a press conference to describe the attack in detail.